growing up, I saw multiple times in our life where we had stuff and then we had nothing. When we left Ethiopia, there was a horrible revolution. We lost everything in that. And so it got me comfortable that even if you have stuff today, it may all go tomorrow. And you shouldn't get too attached to it.
Growing up in Ethiopia, John D'Souza was struck by how parents would wish for rapid death for sick children, knowing that cure might be socially and financially unattainable. Today, he leads MedHelp, which pioneered the field of patient communities on the internet long before WebMD and others got there.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan. David, it seems you were profoundly influenced by your visit to the Austin Medical School that's being built down there in Texas and their quest to train doctors to live in a more cost-efficient medical system.
Yeah, it was an incredibly fascinating experience. So Dell Medical School, they're going to have their first year in 2016. They got a dean and a bunch of people from UCSF and other places. And their thought is that while most medical schools are funded and are based on essentially doing expensive medicine and then there's some extra money based on that that they're able to use. Here, they really want to train a bunch of what they would almost call populationists, physicians who are really focused on cost-efficient care and are able to ferret out waste. And since the medical school was in part funded by an extra real estate tax put on the Austin community that they voted for in Texas, their really thought is to have a partnership with the community and really try to squeeze waste out of the system and deliver more quality, more efficient care.
So does this turn the hospital into a loss center instead of a profit center?
I think they're trying to make the overall health of the community better is how they put it. I think there are some important details, as you've pointed out, that are that remain to be seen. But their basic thought is that if you have as your unit of measurement the overall population, then you ultimately will be able to save the community money by preventing medical events rather than treating it after it happens.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if doctors fall for that. speaking of medical school, our guest, John D'Souza, was once accepted to Harvard Medical School, but actually ended up never getting that degree. Born in Ethiopia, John emigrated to the U.S., only to find he could not fulfill his dream of that medical degree, but found his way to healthcare anyway. John's journey sounds like the stuff of a Michael Lewis book, MIT, Goldman Sachs, successful financial tech entrepreneur, and now healthcare, and yet he spent the largest part of his career on the medical side trying to match people with information and with other people with whom they can share knowledge and experience. Thank you for being here, Don.
Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you.
So tell us a little bit, John, about that Harvard Medical School experience and why you never did go.
Yeah, what were you thinking?
Don't forget, David did go.
Yeah, I think the hard part of that is actually thinking that I could ever get in. But you know, having come from Ethiopia and all, just going to any U.S. institution for education was a dream come true. When I first came to the U.S., I did my first year at UPenn and then had transferred to MIT. And coming into the U.S., all I knew about the U.S. was what I saw from Dallas. So it was a big shock coming in, and I was only 16 at the time, so it was a big shock. But when I'd gone through university, I'd wanted to go into medical school, ended up applying, got into a joint program between MIT and Harvard, the HSC MD PhD program.
Yeah, it's great from what I hear.
rumor has it, it's pretty good. so got into that program, but there was a restriction at the time where if depending on the type of visa you had, you'd have to leave the U.S. for 2 years when you graduated to practice back in your country before you'd practice in the U.S. I didn't have that option coming from Ethiopia. So Howard was really gracious about it. They said, look, go get your green card and come back. Unfortunately, the process took me nearly 13 years to get a green card, which is an unbelievable process, and I don't know how much better it's gotten since then. But
it's about the same as getting an insurance claim.
Yeah, exactly. So I never got a chance to come back and complete it.
What was it like? So your first experience, you were saying, was in Dallas. What was that like? What did you recall? What was some of the...
Well, I just from having watched Dallas on TV, you know, the soap opera. So I landed and I got into Philadelphia, take a cab over to campus, and all I have is a brochure of UPenn. And on the campus, you see a lot of green stuff, and he drops me off in the middle of Philadelphia, which was pretty scary at the time. And I show him the brochure, and he goes, I don't think this is the right place. It's supposed to look like this with all greenery and all. He goes, you know, I think behind that building, they have this patch of greenery you're showing me. I go, what do you mean patch of greenery? He goes, this is it. It was a big shock.
So You came from Ethiopia to go to MIT? You came to go to college?
We left Ethiopia. Ethiopia went through some tough times over there. And so we went through a few countries. I finished my high school in, most of my schooling in Dubai. And then from Dubai, I came to the U.S.
What were your parents doing? What were they?
Doing import-export. And so my dad was initially doing import-export in Ethiopia. And then as we went to other places, kept on doing that.
Interesting. So I heard you tell a story about what made you so interested in healthcare back from when you lived in Ethiopia, about the father and the son. Mm-hmm. Can you tell that story again?
Yeah, this is one where, in Ethiopia, all the village comes around when people need help. And there's a family there where a father had a son who had cancer. And the children usually play outside. So you go and play, and the parents would go in and help the family out. And all I remember, and my mother has recounted this many times, that all I remember is that at a certain point, the father comes out and tells the other parents, pray that my son dies quickly. And it was very profound. It took me many years to really understand it. But it's just the concept of why would a parent ever pray that their child would die quickly? And then and knowing nothing about cancer at the time, you realize later on that if you don't have all the medications, you can suffer a tremendous amount. And at a certain point when you the parent doesn't want the child to suffer anymore. And so it just brought back the full of what can we do to help people? There should be so much more that we can do to help them. And so that's what got me interested in saying how can I go and help people with their health.
So that's what motivated you to apply to med school?
Exactly. Yep.
But you took a pretty significant detour along the way into finance and tech and the like.
Well, I applied to medical school. When I got the deferment is when I took my detour after that. And I did go through, ended up, my father was an entrepreneur, and so I learned a lot about being an entrepreneur, and I think more about what it is to take risk. And I realized that if you have a family and friends around you that love you a lot, it's very easy to take risk because it doesn't matter whether you fail. If I succeed, they'll love me the same amount. If I fail, they'll love me the same amount. So all of us have done a lot of startup stuff, and it gives you, I think, a lot of ability to go there and take risk. So it was very comfortable. I first got a job as very few months as a consultant. My wife was my girlfriend at the time. I told her, look, I have $10,000 in savings. I'm thinking of putting it and trying to start a company with my brother. And she was, great, go for it. Wow. That's how I knew I should get married to her. So that's what I did. My brother and I started a company, and it was just a great to be able to go in and dive in. And when you have the support, taking risk is very easy.
Wow, so you really grew up in an environment that had that view of risk, because I'm not sure that's a universal perspective. I mean, I can imagine people say, well, if you have $10 million, then maybe you can go something risky. But here, the idea of having, some limited amount of resource and then saying, well, that's enough, we're going to go for it and see what you can do. Did you feel a sense of responsibility at that point? Do you think that you were particularly motivated because you knew so many people were counting on you?
I think my family already thought is that if you work very hard, they taught us two values, work hard, love your family, and the value of education. And they always said, if you do that, things will work out. And so growing up, I saw multiple times in our life where we had stuff and then we had nothing. When we left Ethiopia, there was a horrible revolution. We lost everything in that. There were a couple of points
so
in our life when we were in Dubai as well, went through a point where it was a really difficult time. And my mom had to get the school to pay for 5 children. We couldn't pay for it, so they let us all go to school for free at some point. So I saw us have stuff and not have stuff. And so it got me comfortable that even if you have stuff today, it may all go tomorrow, and you shouldn't get too attached to it.
It's so funny because I can imagine, it's such a compelling story, and I can imagine two almost diametrically different reactions. The concept of both having something and then losing it all, I can imagine that would make one be in a situation where whatever you do, let's make sure you protect yourself at all costs and do something ultra conservative so you don't lose all the money. And then on the other hand, it seems like kind of the more almost entrepreneurial attitude that you have is whether you have something or don't at any moment in time, all that can change. And so you might as well go for it.
So that first company started, what was it?
It was an instant messaging company. And my brother
and I... This is back before instant messaging was cool, right?
This is way back. It's in 95. When my brother and I were at MIT, they started this instant messaging service called Zephyr, which immediately became the most popular thing at MIT. Also probably caused a lot of people to fail a few semesters. But when you leave MIT...
It's a precursor to everybody walking down the street texting exactly. Now.
But when we left MIT, what was interesting is that you almost have withdrawal from this instant messaging. We were so used to it. And it wasn't there. So we got together and got some other friends from MIT, and we went through and created a company called Flash Communications. Eventually got bought by Microsoft. But it was, yeah, it was the first company, and this was before all of the recent hype with startups.
So how long were you involved with that company before it was sold?
It was probably about two years that we were involved.
Wow, so that was quick.
Yeah,
quick
it grew, out, huh? it grew quickly. And
so was it the WhatsApp of its day?
Exactly.
And did you... How was that experience for you? Because how old were you then? You're pretty young, right?
Yeah, it was probably about 25 or something.
How was it for you to sell something so quickly that you were excited about?
It was. It's surreal to go there and to have an event that sort of gives you financial independence at an early age, which was great. It allowed me to do a lot of stuff with the family, but. At the same time, it just allowed me to. It wasn't why I was doing it, and didn't change. Honestly, didn't change a lot of things in my life. So we went from there straight into another startup as well. So it was wonderful to be able to do that, to help, you know, to help the family out of that. But it was, I think the experience was great. Just going through an entrepreneurial experience, I think, is a wonderful one.
Mm-hmm. And especially when it's good.
Well, you know, part of it is good, and I think. But you know, even if it's not good, because even I feel that any startup until the exit. There are a lot of points at which you think you always think you're going to go bankrupt until eventually. So there are a lot of paths that are not, but I think the full process of it is a really important one to go through.
Can you elaborate on that, though? Because I think that's a story a lot of entrepreneurs don't tell, which is those moments where you think you're going to lose it all.
Yeah, there are, and this is where I think where you need the support around you, because there are so many points along the way where you're worrying about payroll. Can I meet payroll? What do I do? If I don't make payroll, I'm probably going to jail. So there are a lot of issues that you have along the way. So you know, it's never a linear process. And it's one of those where I think being an entrepreneur teaches you that you can't live in the past. Because if you do, there are points where somebody may have come to buy the company, you decide to walk away. If you start living, oh, I should have, you are going to go crazy.
Do you recall a specific moment during the course of that Flash company where you really were sitting thinking, oh my, you know, a specific moment in time where you remember thinking, oh my goodness, what's going to happen tomorrow, or how are we going to get past this?
Yeah, I remember, you know, it was a funny moment, one where we had a very big deployment going on, and we all thought things were going very well. This was going on for a few months, and then we realized a few months later in a conversation that this was an international deployment, where the person goes, you know, it goes well, you know, love everything you do, except that apparently the software was logging them out every 4 or 5 minutes. And they had to log in continuously. I said, oh my God, this is a
suboptimal.
This is a disaster. And it's one that your heart just sinks and goes, this is our number one deployment. And for 6 months, everyone user has been logged out every few minutes.
Wow.
And that's when I say, oh my God. So you have a lot of those where, you know, you just can go from a huge high to back down saying, well, you know, will we be able to make it through this? So there were several points, and even at MedHelp, lots of points where you go through and go, you know, will we make it over the next few months?
So I think about, you know, all the work, and this is a bit of a detour, but all the work being done in digital health with texting and, you know, that equivalent technology today to improve the delivery of healthcare in Africa and places like that. Have you seen an improvement? I mean, if I went back to your village, assuming it exists anymore, I don't know, but would they be using technologies like that, or would they be thinking, is there better access now in your experience?
So I do think that cell phones are really all over the place. You know, to Ethiopia, a lot of people are using it, and it is helping people connect a lot. So it's bringing people a lot closer. I think it has improved the livelihood a lot, and that has translated into helping them with health. So I think the largest impact can be in Africa. There's a lot more we need to do, because it has helped the communication part. It hasn't helped some of the infrastructure part that they need to do. But the people who need help and can't get a message out, that has gone away. You can get the messages.
So it's sort of interesting, because one of the critiques that one hears sometimes of things like, say, iPhones or the research kit is that, oh, you're getting a totally skewed demographic of, like, you know, like rich techies in Silicon Valley. But then when you hear people who sort of study it in more depth, they say, actually, mobile phones have been one of the best examples of broad deployment of technology diffusion, and that have had the broadest impact the fastest. And it sounds like your experience is almost more in that second category.
Exactly. And I can tell you, in 2008, when we were working on MedHelp, I'd gone to India, and I was taking a rickshaw, and the person asked me, what do you do? And I said, I work at a company called MedHelp. He goes, yeah, I know the company. I was like, what? And he showed me how he used his phone to access it. And it was just profound that to see somebody who's riding a rickshaw that could access the Q&A we had on the site through. So it is very powerful what people can go through and do. And I feel that in a lot of these other countries, people are a lot more proficient in what they can do because they have to be.
And I guess it also sort of speaks to the broadest shift that we've seen over the last 5 years, let's say towards mobile, would seem to be a really nice fit for some of the, would seem to mesh more naturally with some of these communities that you're describing.
Yeah, exactly right. They need it a lot more. They're willing to invest to learn it and go through. There's a great YouTube video where they put that computer in a village and they watch how the kids interact with it. And it's incredible where how quickly they can go through and learn how to use it. So I definitely have seen that where people are willing, give it to them a few weeks later, they know exactly how to use it because they need it.
What's the limiting factor? Is it connectivity? I know Google is trying to put, you know, in balloons with like internet connections and stuff. What's the limiting factor that's preventing technology from diffusing even faster and helping more people in some of the countries you're describing?
So one is the cost of cell phones, and you know, the cost has been dropping very quickly, and China has helped a lot with producing phones that are really cheap that can go through. So that is one, is just getting the costs down. The second is you need a little bit of financial innovation to how do you allow people to pay for it. They can't pay for it up front, but often when they use it, it can improve their business and they'll be able to pay it over time. And the third is getting the cell towers. Ironically, though, there are a lot of interesting ways, and one cell tower can cover a group of people. It's in the places that are very sparse that gets tough, and that's where you need new technologies to do it.
So MedHelp was way ahead of its time compared to all of the companies that came behind it, focusing on the power of community, this thing you're discussing, to improve the healthcare consumer's experience. What do you think about the lag between sort of when you guys started? I know you weren't there from the very beginning, but the company started in 1994, I think.
Yep.
You know, long before the WebMDs and the others, and certainly all the many companies now focused on community and patient engagement and all that.
It was way ahead of its time. I mean, it's amazing.
Are you encouraged by what you see now? Or are you discouraged that it took so long?
You know, there are two different. It was ahead of its time, but I think it was really ahead of its time in two things. One is putting the patient, I think of it as a consumer, at the center of it. And right now, there's all this patient-centered care, but people still don't know what patient-centered care is. Often, patient-centered care doesn't involve the patient. So I think that, in terms of understanding that a long time ago, that's really profound. The second thing that they were ahead of time was in realization that in health, the outcome depends on the journey, and wanting to go through and help people with their journey through health. So they were, if you think that they did that back in 1994, you think by now it would be far ahead. But I just recently went for, and it's a slight aside, but I went for an MRI, and the experience makes me shocked that we're in 2015. So I go in, and they go, you can log into my chart. So I pull out my phone, and the nurse says, no, when you get home, do it when you get home. So I go home, and go on the machine, and typing in, the registration is really complicated, it takes half an hour, and they ask you questions such as, what's the middle name of your youngest child? And I go, wait, the youngest child depends on when you ask me that, because could be this. So they ask you these questions that don't make any sense. Eventually, and they go, congratulations, you know, you're registered. In 48 hours, we'll email you an activation code.
Oh my goodness.
I go, in 2 hours, I can have a grill delivered to my house. You take 48 hours to send me an activation code? So wait, 2 days later, they send me this activation code that's, you know, in the old CDs, there was this 25 digits that were really complex here to type in? It's exactly like that. So they have this 25 digits that have, you can't cut and paste it for security reasons. You have to type it, and it takes you another half an hour to get it right. You go in, and the only thing inside it is this, they have the diagnosis and a link to a glossary. And so they spent all this time to get this. So it's sad in some ways that we have gone far. In other ways, it is atrocious at what we have. So it's a mixed feeling.
Wow. That's both incredible and utterly believable.
Yeah.
But I mean, you do hear about efforts that sound more constructive, like open notes, like where it seems like people are there's the concept of the patient truly being more in the middle, and really running things seems to be sort of really taking center stage. When you describe about experiences where you, have you had an experience where you've seen it done right anywhere, where you're either a healthcare system or some situation where you've looked at it and you said, oh, this seems to be much closer to truly putting the patient in the middle, and you've seen the impact it could make?
You know, I've seen a lot of the people who are developing apps and all have done an incredible job. You see, but they've really started off saying, what is it that the user wants, and going through and doing it. So I've seen new technologies come out that that I think are really impressive and go very far. Even a lot right now in terms of what people are doing with being able to do these teleconsults where you can actually go through and get the and speak to a doctor on the phone. A lot of the new implementations of that are very impressive because if you have a quick question, making an appointment and all is stuff. And I actually joked that for a while, I gave up on having a primary care physician because I feared that in the end, either I'll fully recover or I'll die before I get to my appointment with them. So you just go, there's no point, but you call them in 10 weeks, they'll see you. So I think people are doing a lot of interesting things there. But there's a lot more we have to do. And you hear a lot of like meaningful use. The sad part of that is it's not really meaningful and there's no use. But other than that, it's great. Yeah, exactly. Other than that, it's beautiful. It's great that everybody has to do it.
Well, there was a story I read. I was at HIMSS last week, and the story I read was that something like 80% of the medical records have errors in them. And so you can open them to people, but like, what good is that, right? I mean, it's like, what good is it if you can't use it for something meaningful? Because forget the meaningful use. You can't use it literally for something meaningful if it's mistaken. And I think, it's really stunning how poor it is. But I see now there's this whole movement of companies to use the community to crowdsource knowledge, to crowdsource recommendations, diagnosis. There's companies like Smart Patients, for people with cancer and help arounds, there's Patients Like Me, all these companies that really are creating that community concept, but you've been doing that a really long time.
And I think the full idea of a lot of the, even how people do clinical trials are on such small populations, and once you get done with it, there's so little follow-up beyond that. And I'll show you a similar example with my son. He has really bad allergies. He went to the doctor and they gave him medication. The medication was way too strong for him. He could hardly wake up in the morning. So what I did with him, and he was using at the time a Jawbone, I used that to track his sleep. So when he was asleep, he'd go through and when he didn't take the medication, he'd probably wake up about 20 times at night. If he took the dosage, it was over-sedated. So what we did is we started off with a quarter of the medication and saw how he did. And a third, it was perfect. A third, he slept beautifully. So he used only 30% of the recommended dosage and it worked perfectly for him.
Well, so you were able to titrate using as your feedback the sleep report.
That's the first time I've heard of an actual use of the Fitbit for something.
I've heard of a couple, but I know what you mean.
But it worked really well. And after that, for him, he could actually look at his sleep as well and say, oh, I'm sleeping well, I'm not sleeping well. So it was a great way for him to just monitor and know, how he was doing. So it worked really, really well.
Must be profound for you to be able to care for your child like that, knowing what you saw as a child that got you into healthcare in the first place.
Yeah.
The father and the child.
It's great to be able to go, and also when you start looking at some of the data, it shows you some very different things. My children go to school in Japan during the summer, and it was interesting to see that when they're in Japan, they probably walk or run around about 30 to 40% more than they do in the US. Huh. I was just shocking to see the data. Okay, here's the data. But it's such a different experience. So it's interesting what you learn about it on a day-to-day basis just by looking at the data.
I know, this is such a revolution. It's like, wow, there's all this tracker data that's useful, right?
Well, it's fascinating to think about using it, to manage your children's health. I've never really thought about that much. I mean, there's a few companies that have made attempts, to get there, but the parents are so different.
My kids' Fitbits to try to encourage this. We actually try to have family fitness goals, and didn't last very long. But it was. I like the idea. I think we're going to get back to that. Yeah. So, but it's I do think that there's a huge value of because initially these are you can join these fitness groups because they're thinking if you're 20 something, what do you care about what your friends are doing? But I think the idea of being able to take some of those same instincts and focus that on the family seems very interesting.
So MedHelp gets very little publicity, right? You never hear about MedHelp. You hear about all these, companies lately, but that's one that is a name that you don't hear a lot about. Do you guys intentionally keep yourselves under the radar?
Yeah, I think a lot of us was to focus on the consumer at the end. So we actually spend no money on marketing. We didn't spend any money on the
PR. But you have millions and millions of users.
So we have 16 million users that come every month. So we're just focusing on that as opposed to doing the standard route of going through. Especially people go through, you try and raise money, you go do all of the big press. But it takes away a lot of what you'd be doing towards the product. So we never went that under route. Part of what's interesting is when you look at the conferences, especially health.o, if I look at the first ones I went to, 90% of the companies are not there anymore. They got a lot of press. In fact, some of them got press until the week before they went in. So I just said, look, what I need is just to help users. We can reach them. And the power of reach, actually, for example, we have this I'm Expecting Pregnancy app. And last year, we reached over almost 45% of all U.S. pregnant women used it.
Really?
Wow.
So that's the real reach. If you get there, and on Thursday of last week, one of our users sent us a link to a video and just says, thought you'd enjoy this, and did this full video that his wife uses that I'm expecting, and it's right center of the video to show how they use that. He wasn't even about it, but it happened to be right there. So you were talking about often when you create this, you want to create this emotional bond with the user. But it was the first time I saw the user creating the emotional bond back to us. Wow. So it's very profound because normally I see the effectiveness through the data. Right. And this time I could see it in a video. So it gave me goosebumps watching it to see the power of the way they used it, how it touched them, and the fact that he reached back out to say, look, here's the value, what do you guys do?
That's so interesting, the whole data side of this too, given the size of the reach that you have and the amount of data you must be able to collect on people. I think about like what IBM Watson is trying to do right now and to become that central repository, at least the entity that can analyze the central repository were it to exist. Are you in that business as well?
We collect over 2 gigs of data every day. So we have a tremendous amount of data coming in. And I'd worked on the Watson Deep Blue a long time ago. So I really enjoyed it and think that it's very profound. Then there's a tremendous amount of data here. We do a really poor job in health of analyzing it. And you compare, for example, this versus finance. With finance, you know, they find out how to take a millisecond and convert that into a lot of money. So they do a lot of analysis there. We need to do a much better job of taking all those deep analysis and bringing it over here. It's much more important, and we need to get better at it.
So what's the comparable app we should have in healthcare or applicator, you know, analog?
Well, I feel what we miss at is we're getting a stage right now where we're collecting data, but I feel as if in health, it's not so much just about data. We need good data, and we need to be able to see the impact of the data. So people collect a lot of data. There are very few good tools that look through it and tell you any sort of impact. I did a manual analysis once, so I realized that I have been tracking my runs and all my exercise for a long time, and I realized that every now and then, especially when I was going skiing and I was walking uphill, I would nearly pass out. And as I was getting older, it got worse and worse. I'd run in the winter and get bad. Initially, I went to the doctor and he told me, look, you're getting old, stop doing this. So I wasn't very convinced of that. So I went and looked at the data across it, and it was very clear that if the temperature was below basically about 40 degrees, my heart rate went up above 160. I felt really bad. And I tested it out one day, and I did a run. I pushed myself running uphill when it was cold, and he goes, oh, this is asthma that's induced by cold and exercise. And he goes, that's a lot more useful than you getting old. So I feel that...
They're not mutually exclusive.
Exactly. No,
but in theory, what was nice is you were also able to attach that onto essentially an existing structure. What I mean, some of the real potential that people would like to see is from the raw data, being able to sort of abstract that, oh, we see a subset of people who under conditions A, B, and C, this particular thing happens. Because, there's a phenomenon, I remember Bill Crowley, a master general, would always talk about this, how whenever he'd write a paper on some new phenomenon using endocrinology that he would describe, all of a sudden people come out of the woodwork having that phenomenon, and there's the opportunity to try to do some of that with the help of some of these rich integrated data sets that you're describing.
Yeah, I think that's, I think it's interesting that you've figured out how to use your own data mm-hmm. for your own diagnostics in your home. Yeah. You know, and I think there's so many people that aren't ready to do that, and then there's people who kind of live in this data world mm-hmm. and are oriented that way. I mean, you come out of tech and finance and, you know, and combine that with healthcare, it kind of leads you to that path, I would think. But the average person, I'm not sure is thinking about
that. But there are also so many people, I mean, these ultra-quantified selves, and it just seems self-indulgent. I mean, you know, and it, I mean, God bless them, but it doesn't necessarily seem like it's translating into anything that would have an immediate impact.
And especially not at scale. Right. I think that's where we need to get it. It needs to be very simple, and it has to be done at scale to be able to go through and have the impact. Right now, if for an individual, you can dive in, get the resources, but that doesn't work. So I think we have to automate it. We need much better tools. The tools already exist out there in other areas. We just need to bring a lot more of it over to, over to health.
What's the one change that you're most looking forward to seeing in the next several years in healthcare?
I would say the one thing that I feel frustrated about is I feel that sometimes regulations don't help us well. And even a simple percentage is HIPAA. I feel HIPAA, for me, it sometimes is a joke because you go to hospitals, they just tell you to sign here. They don't even mention it's a HIPAA form they're signing. You sign it or you get it in the mail and this, that. But at the same time, I feel as if there's still a debate as to who owns your data. How do you get it? Why is it so hard? That I feel as if we need to simplify it so that people actually do own the data, they have the rights to the data, and they do what they want with the data.
So two comments on that. One, I really agree with some of the comments that Harvard's Zach Cohaney has made about this, and, you know, and for example, in an article in the New Yorker last year, where he said he thinks a lot of times academic researcher, and he's a leading academic researcher, and he says a lot of times academic researchers seem to hide behind HIPAA and to use it as an excuse or sort of shorthand for not sharing data. But on the really positive side, I'm incredibly excited by, for example, what Apple's Research Kit is doing and by the idea of putting an increasing amount of data in the hands of patients and really letting them decide. You know, this Genes for Good is an example of one of those projects. Variety, and I think the work that John Wilbanks has done on creating appropriate consent and letting more people participate with actually better consent and more broadly, I think has the real opportunity to really transform the locus of control, really, from these academic institutions or from these hospitals, I hope, towards the patient, just like you're sort of saying what we need to do.
It was ironic. A couple of weeks ago, I got one of those letters in the mail thing from Anthem saying that all of your information was...
If you want to buy Lisa Soonan's social security number, it's on Amazon.com. Yeah, I know.
Well, it was funny. Basically saying that they stole all of my health data. But if somebody had stolen my health data, I was actually hoping... I wonder if they saw more value in that data than I ever did. Because
well, that's
was
the funny thing. They don't steal, you know, the funny thing is, that's the joke of it, is they don't actually ever steal the health data part of it. I mean, I heard about like some blackmail kids, but usually it's actually for the credit card numbers, right?
Exactly. So here you are now, all these years later, 20 years later or so, in the life of MedHelp anyway, and your own experience in the medical world. Do you still wish you'd gone to medical school?
You know, I feel as I've had a very large impact. I would have loved, it's an area that I love, and I keep on saying maybe as I get old I should go back to medical school and learn it. I love it, and I miss the ability to touch people on that individual personal basis. What I have been able to do is touch on a much larger scale, which is very fulfilling. But you know, I would have loved to have had that degree.
Interesting. I think it is interesting because I think you have been able to touch people on a pretty profound basis in a way that most doctors really never get to do. So it's pretty cool.
Absolutely. No question. Their loss.
Well, thanks, John. This was great. Really enjoyed having you here today.
No, thank you for having me.
Experience having you here.
Thank you.